Is this the best material we have?
I mean, it's the material that we have, period. Yeah,
that's a good point.
Best or worst. You're storing memories to lose them again. You'll forget everything when this whole thing ends. You can't even predict what tomorrow brings. But don't lose track of living in the present. Welcome to the Memory Distillery, everyone. I'm Anthony Verneri.
And I'm John Deck, and each week we will malt, mash, ferment, and distill our way through the spirits of our past in the form of long-loved movies.
And this week, look on the bright side, you can't be any worse than old Toad Face. That's right, we're watching Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix from 2007, directed by David Yates. This is the fifth of seven installments in our Harry Potter series that we are doing on the show. And it just keeps getting better, kind of, doesn't it, John?
I mean, it certainly builds on itself, and the overall experience keeps flowering into something amazing.
It does. I'm very. I think we found a really nice groove with this series. I think that it's going to turn out really great at the end. We've got a lot to look forward to with this episode. We're introduced to some new characters, and you know, Dolores Umbridge and Kingsley Shacklebolt. You know, some we may like, some we may not. John, what are you looking forward to?
Well, as you said, we're certainly hitting the old Cuzco groove that we've made famous back when we reviewed Emperor's New Groove episode.
Way back when.
I don't know. I'm going to guess 22. I have no clue.
I think it's like, eight or nine.
Oh, wow. Well, seeing as how that's that. This is, I want to read to you just an excerpt that I somehow came across. I just saved for Order of the Phoenix when we got to here. This is a description of this movie, and this is kind of how I feel about it. You ready?
I'm ready.
A dark tide is rising in the wizarding world. Key positions of power are being taken over by members of a fascist cult whose leader demands absolute personal loyalty while giving none in return. Their campaign of fear, paranoia, fake news, and racial animus threatens to tear the magical realm apart. And, you know, it was like, yeah, that's what's happening. No, I as we keep saying, like with each installment, as we dig deeper, it gets a little darker in tone. It gets a little more serious and, you know.
And black.
It's getting seriouser and blacker. And then we lead into the point now where there's no more hints. There's no more tiptoeing around. There's no more vaguely threatening things on the horizon, foreshadowing and you know, just vaguely threatening basilisks, things like that. Now we're into the serious. We're into the seriousness here, and so I'm continuing to get excited because I really enjoy, in a lot of stories, when they take the long road and you get the epic build up and the development and the characters and we keep continuing here. I think we hit peak bad hair for Harry was Goblet of Fire, I think. So from here on out, that's my main concern, is that hair gets back in order and I can feel good about it. But outside of that, like you said, you know, some of the different characters and getting to, you know, have the real Mad-Eye Moody and, you know, all these different things, that's going to be a lot of fun. And yeah, I mean, as we go, I feel like I have less and less to say about each of these because I get more and more excited to continue the story. So, I mean, I'm just ready to just jump right back into the fray and you know, really, really get into the nuts and bolts of what's going to go on and the setting the stages for this, like, war.
Yeah, and, you know, seeing, like, the starts of Dumbledore's army and stuff like that, I think that's going to be a very cool thing to experience as well. We're going to go and watch this. It's currently streaming. If you have Sling or USA, it's streaming on those. But otherwise, you're going to have to catch it on one of the streaming rental services or from your personal library, as John and I will be doing. But when we come back, we are talking Actually, before I say that, you know, we've got more Dreamcasting coming up. We've got more fun and games coming up with Pottermore and maybe some more BuzzFeed quizzes. And a little more information about the giveaway that we have coming up. So stay tuned for all of that. And when we come back, we're talking Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. John, are you ready?
Expelliarmus.
That's a spell. That's a proper
Hogwarts spell. It's Latin for let's do it.
Let's do it. Welcome back, everyone. John, mm-hmm. When I first started watching the movie, you have probably the first 20 or so minutes, like kind of between the opening credits and when they're getting onto the Hogwarts Express. And I had two moments that I kind of retitled things. One, instead of the Ally G Show, it was the Dudley G Show, which is harder to say than it is to write down.
Apparently.
Because Dudley, like, of course, is some, like, chav kid who is garbage. And the other one was My Chemical Voldemort, because of how Voldemort is dressed on the platform.
Okay, that's a little better. You're improving. Yep. I mean, and of course, I was thinking... Order of the Phoenix, more like Order of the Kleenex, because you're sad that at the end.
Yes.
So yeah, we that's definitely things that I was thinking of the whole night.
I did want to. I don't exactly recall. Do you remember who I casted for Sirius Black?
I remember all.
Okay.
No, I don't know. That's your responsibility.
Okay. Great. Well,
no, yeah, because you picked Michael Sheen.
Oh, I did pick Michael Sheen.
Because I picked him as Lupin.
Oh, see, I kind of want to recant that now, because in watching Order of the Phoenix, I got this Dave Grohl vibe, and so that's who I want to play Sirius Black now.
That's kind of awesome. I, being such a fan of Dave Grohl's and just imagining him in that role, I'm willing to allow it. Let's bend those rules and set that up.
Excellent.
As long as we're talking about segues, Dave Grohl immediately makes me think of his recent drum battles with the young Nandi Bushel. Have you had a chance to see those?
I've not. I'm about to, though.
You absolutely need to. She is this kind of precocious, insane, kind of awesome drummer. I believe she's British. At least she has an accent. But yeah, she's been doing like YouTube covers of some pretty awesome drum parts for a while, and those are just fun and all, but then she challenged Dave Grohl and she was playing the drum part for Everlong, and he responded to the challenge playing it, and then he challenged
this
her.
This is amazing.
And, yeah, they went back and forth for at least like four videos, and like he wrote a song for her with an awesome drum part just to challenge her again. And like, so you'll have to catch up on those later. I encourage anyone who likes
this is so cool too. I'm watching Dead End Friends, yeah. And her face is so emotive and fun. It's hilarious.
If we were casting kids in Harry Potter, I think I'd want to try to get her into some role, because she's just so much fun.
She'd be my Hermione. No, yeah, she's fantastic. I have to watch more of these.
Yeah, you'll have to catch up on those. So, anyway, allow us to get back into Order of the Phoenix. And
yes, and let's.
Dave Grohl as Sirius Black is perfectly fine with me. Yeah, we were talking about after, you know, Goblet of Fire, of this transition into the world just becoming a bit more stark and dark. And the movie did not disappoint. We had these, you know, moments here and there of levity, which of course you need in any movie, no matter, you know, not any movie, but, you know, it helps balance some of the tone of things and you have fun with it. And Fred and George, they're scamps. What you gonna do? but by and large, the very beginning with Ally G, was that who you were saying?
Yeah, Dudley G.
Yeah, I'm trying to humor you. But the whole beginning with the Dementors in the park, I guess you would call it, or, you know, like a swing set in the middle of a farm in England. I don't know. But
wherever... that's what passes for a park in jolly old England. Sure.
I'm not gonna shake and rattle against that. I believe that's perfectly fine. But yeah, like right from the beginning, it's just like, oof. And then to go from the Dementor attack to having to deal with like being put on trial, and like you could tell the tone right away is just they're not going to take a long time to feed into like childlike fantasies of going away to a magic school, and then slowly something dangerous or weird happens. It's like, bam, you're right in the middle of it. So I like that kind of pacing, especially for, I mean, the book for Order of the Phoenix, I just remember being, I mean, I don't know if it was the longest or if it was just...
It's up there. It's got to be top two or three as far as longest in the series goes.
So it's like whenever that happens now, of course, you know, Deathly Hallows, they split that into two movies. But I remember just thinking the idea of trying to cram this into one movie, and ends up actually being a shorter runtime than the last one we watched, than Goblet of Fire, by, you know, a few minutes. But these are all hefty 2.5, 2 hour, 20 minute movies. But the pacing was pretty good. I feel like they really set their mind. By they, I mean, was this Yates who directed this one?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
Like, I think they really, he and, you know, the writer, you know, made sure that they were hitting the major points, getting to where they needed to go, but really kind of keeping it faithful to the overall story. So what did you love? We keep talking the last several movies, there have been moments or things that we love. Was there a moment for that for you in this movie?
So I don't think that I had, I mean, you have your emotional scene at the end, which we'll kind of get to, but I don't think I had the same sort of depth of emotion when it came to attachment in this movie. I think that there were sequences that I thought were very well done, especially like the montage scene in the secret room where they're all training in defense of the dark arts, and you know, Harry's teaching them all how to defend themselves and different spells and charms and things like that.
The Room of Requirement.
The Room of Requirement, yes. I think that entire sequence was super well done. And even like the Harry's first kiss with Cho, and how like right after it's like in the common room, oh, tell us what it was like, blah, 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 blah. Like that whole sort of coming of age teenage thing, I thought was good, without being overdone and like weird and creepy. And then obviously we have the end scene, which is very emotional.
I feel like when I started watching this, it could have been Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix : Harry gets a haircut. because
finally
in the books he's very disheveled, and that's fine, but like in Goblet of Fire, that's, I think it's the only movie where his hair's a little out of control, and I don't hate it, but this one is just so funny to see him start off. He looks so fresh and so clean. But yeah, like the everything you described, I mean, those are all good points here. I for having some, you know, probably the most like heart-wrenching moment from the books, one of the top three, I'd say, for me, that the same impact wasn't held as like some of like with Cedric and his father and stuff. So like that isn't necessarily like my number one scene or pick for in terms of impact, but I do like the Room of Requirement, you know, defense against the dark arts training stuff, like both how they did it and just that whole process of them knowing that they needed something that was real and they needed actual help. And it was like, well, we should turn to Harry because he has more experience in this than anything. And what I really love is that whole approaching it with humility and just being like, I mean, honestly, a lot of it was just luck. And they're like, oh, but you know, even, you know, Cedric was beaten by, you know, Voldemort, and, you know, but you weren't, and he's like, no, Cedric was awesome, like, he was really good, and then, like, just that whole thing of, trying to not help them, you know, not to build his own image up, not to, you know, swell up in pride over everything. But, you know, he really, you know, you said you like, you know, Remus as, you know, the best defense against the dark arts teacher. And then, mm-hmm. and then here, I think Harry kind of takes over as being the best of really understanding what they're going through, some practical applications, some actual, in the moment, you're going to need this one quick thing here or there. And then, you know, we see these lessons take hold later on and have some effectiveness.
Well, and the thing that I like most about that, I think, is it strikes the David Yates and the writers and even J.K. Rowling, they strike this really good balance of humility. I'm glad that you used that word, between Harry and the students, because like the other students have lived in the world of magic, most of them, their entire lives. They weren't raised by muggles. They weren't, you know, exposed as much to the muggle world as Harry was. Harry grew up, he knew nothing but a world without magic, except for his sort of accidental dalliances in that, you know, with his parcel tongue and making the glass disappear, as we see in Sorcerer's Stone. So you have that humility from the students, like, oh, wow, like this kid who 5 years ago hadn't even heard of magic is now teaching us how to defend ourselves. But then the same humility that you described with Harry, like, no, like everyone's better than me. Like Cedric was a fucking beast. He fucking killed it with, you know, his magical ability.
And that's a direct quote. I remember that.
Yeah, that's exactly how I just read it off of IMDb.
Yeah.
Cedric was a beast. But yeah, like I think that was, they did a good job of building that rapport and that story and that relationship between student and teacher, even though they were peers.
Now, I have to say, now that I'm thinking about it, because I had to think of something while you were talking, so I'd be prepared to talk. You know how that goes.
Yeah.
I did just podcasting. Have a flash recall of probably my favorite moment, even though I liked it better in the book. I can keep comparing. I know we're trying to keep things as pure as possible, but it's towards the end as Umbridge gains more and more power, and she's ultimately, you know, gonna, they find the whole Room of Requirement, and they go to Dumbledore, and that whole exchange with the, it says Dumbledore's army on it. I guess that's me, isn't it? And Harry's like, no, we did it. Like, that whole thing. And they're like, okay, well, I hope you're ready for Azkaban and stuff. And his whole, like, oh, were you under the impression you were going to take me in quietly? Or whatever, that thing. And then he's just, poof, and he's gone. Like, I love that build up in that moment. That's a good one.
To tack on to the end of it, the line that Shacklebolt has at the end, he says, right as he does it, Kingsley Shacklebolt goes, "You may not like a minister, but you can't deny Dumbledore's got style." And I'm just like, yeah.
So that's some good stuff in there, and you know, to get this out of the way real quick, the whole annoying meter for...
I was actually just going to bring that up.
You got Ron, Hermione, and Harry. And, you know, I felt more sympathetic for Harry than I thought I was going to. He did not annoy me. I feel his anger was very warranted. And I was more pissed at Dumbledore as I'm watching. And I'm just like, damn it, just talk to him. Like, no, this is not going to fix everything by you just, like, holding back and being like, well, I thought if I didn't talk to you, maybe I wouldn't be... Like, no! And so, like, I was mad at Dumbledore. I wasn't mad at Harry. And
we're not judging Dumbledore, though. You need to You need to focus on the kids.
So, yeah. So Harry, like I said, actually, you know what? Because it's so didn't irritate me on any level, I'm going to go and say that Harry and Hermione were both at about, you know, a 1 or 2, and Ron was like at a 3, because by default, Ron's more annoying.
So I my table's turned here a little bit. I went a little different from you. I didn't give Harry as much the benefit of the doubt as you did.
Sure.
I initially
especially before they got into the Room of Requirement and he was, you know, doing his thing and really, you know, kind of showing what he was worth, I had him at about a 7. And I brought it got pulled back once he, like, really stepped up, and even more so as we got, like, into the ministry. So I had Harry at about a 4, and then Ron and Hermione both at about a 2.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought, like, after we transitioned from emo Harry to angry Harry, which, you know, are cousins of some sort, but I thought,
yeah.
I thought I would find it annoying and, like, I hate it when you have a character who's a bit out of character for the point of the story, and then you're just waiting for them to get back in character. And this, like, that wasn't the case here. I really felt like, you know, he, unlike that, like, Harry and Ron fight at the beginning of, you know, Goblet of Fire that went on, like, 20 minutes too long, where it was just,
did you tell, like, him?
Yeah, like, all that stuff, I was over it after about a minute. But here, it just was like, surprisingly, I did not feel annoyed at all. Like I said, I really was just, I was like, man, this is rough, and it's only going to get rougher every minute from here on out. Like, he doesn't even know what he needs to do. He doesn't know the prophecy. He doesn't know what he's going to have to try to accomplish to actually take out, Voldemort. Like, he doesn't know any of these things yet, and yet still, things are kind of rough.
So, you make good points there, and I want to validate my 4 here, because I feel like I need to after those points that you make. My main gripe was, A, the whininess, like, throughout the first half of the movie, and then B, the sort of weird rage Harry, and, like, I get it as a plot device, and I get that, like, he's feeding off of Voldemort, and that's, you know, that's sort of how it is, but it almost seemed like Daniel Radcliffe had overdone it and had kind of pushed a little too hard, and so it came off as, I don't know, off-putting. So that's why you got a 4 from me.
All right, that's fair. I mean, we're talking about, you know, ratings for these characters, and you said we're just rating those 3 kids, but I gotta tell you, Dumbledore, I love his character, and I love that I get annoyed with him. So I'm not saying he's not a good character, but, and I appreciate you have this character who is kind of set up to be nearly omnipotent, like he's just super high level. And again, not like, I mean, obviously he doesn't just, he can't destroy Voldemort, you know, like it's not like he can just beat him, sure. but with all of his finesse and wisdom and style, as you point out, or as Kingsley did, like he's set up in this way that you see in a lot of movies where you have the old wise character who is more or less perfect, but they need like a younger character to be the main character who's not as good that grows. And I like the fact that Dumbledore here, he's got issues, you know, things have informed his growth over time. His experiences in the past that, you know, we get to learn about after this series of movies, but like there's a lot that goes into that. And the fact and his reasoning behind these things may make some amount of sense, but at the same time, it's messed up and it doesn't work very well. And things could have been so much better had there been a different way of thinking about things, a different way of communicating, instead of just that idea that he knows best, he's going to take things on himself, he's going to make decisions for other people and just keep them ignorant of what's, you know, what's happening, you know, all that internal dialogue that went on in his head to keep all these other things from happening. Ultimately, you know, things unravel in a way that's ultimately not exactly wonderful.
Well, and I got the sense from this movie that it was ultimately trying to, like, put you on your heels and make you kind of rethink how you feel about everything when it comes to, you could probably say the same for the book as well, like how you feel about the characters and the environment of the story. Like, you have Snape, who up to this point you kind of hate. Like, yeah you love Alan Rickman because he's Alan Rickman, but Severus Snape is a dick, and he shows it through and through in every one of these movies. including this one, but he finally, like, is helpful. Like, he's trying to teach Harry how to defend his mind against Voldemort, and he's, you know, sidestepping Dolores Umbridge. The scene where she's interviewing him and asking him about his, you know, application for defense against the dark arts, and she's like, but you were unsuccessful. He goes, obviously. Like, that whole bit, and then, like, Ron laughing and Snape hitting him, like, that whole thing was fantastic. But,
and you know, he still had Veritas potion.
Oh, of course. Yeah, so. There's no way that, like, he goes, oh no, you used the last of it on Cho. Like, he said that for Harry's benefit, so he stopped hating Cho. But he becomes more than just the most hated professor at Hogwarts. He becomes someone who is trying to help the end goal. And yeah. Like, you get that sense finally. Same thing goes for Dumbledore, for every reason that you just described. Like, he's completely turned the way that he's trying to prevent the return of Voldemort and the destruction of the school, and, you know, trying to protect Harry, and you begin to get pissed off at him because, like, he's not the Dumbledore that we've seen for the last four movies. And yes, obviously, only two of those four because it was a different actor, but, like, the character, I feel, at the end of the day, is the same. So Ron is more helpful. Hermione is less motherly, and, like, she's trying to be less a mother and more of a friend, and, like, that's important to her character development. And, you know, we finally get to really experience Sirius for more than just, you know, a minute in one movie and then as a fire in another movie. And, like, it's Harry Potter and the Reordering of the Expectations. It should be the name of this movie.
No, I think it should be Harry Potter and the Order of the Kleenex. Hashtag blessed.
Hashtag blessed.
yeah, I do. Your point about Snape is well taken. Kind of the opposite of, not opposite, but different, opposing, but similar to Dumbledore. And the fact that these are real characters who are complex and aren't just the good guy or the bad guy. But that doesn't mean we're going to flip the expectation and make Snape awesome and good. Like, he's perfect. We just had the wrong idea. Like, no, he still is conflicted. He still has issues. It's still very, all of these things can be true. And so, yeah.
That shows through. Like, when Harry turns the tide on him and, you know, reads through his mind and sees his memories with his own father.
Yeah.
And then Snape's like, you're done. We're finished here. We're not doing this anymore. Like, that's another character flaw. Like, oh no, I should keep teaching you, but no, fuck it, you're done. Like, get the fuck out of my office.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, clearly our our delving into the character of Snape is going to expand quite a bit into the next movie, and that'll be, you know, awesome to see as well.
Yes, indeed.
So let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
Do you like coffee?
I love coffee, John.
The reason I ask is, I had someone who, I'll say maybe they might have challenged me a little bit about our Harry Potter series. They might have said something along the lines of, you guys aren't being weird enough. You're taking the safe quizzes. You're going the easy route. You're figuring out what your patroni are. But what about drinking some coffee to figure out who you are in the Hogwarts, you know, universe, in the Harry Potter universe? And I was like, well, that's a really interesting point. But oh, look, a BuzzFeed quiz that's all about preparing, picking out your mug, getting into what kind of coffee beverage you'd enjoy, all the details. And once you go through a series of selections, it then magically tells you, as though you were in Professor Trelawney's class, it reveals to you the truth of who you are. So you want to walk me through who you are based upon coffee?
Well, I'd love to. So I actually took the quiz shortly before we started recording this portion of the show. And based on the mug, the type of coffee that I'm craving, by the way, it's Irish coffee. It's always Irish coffee. I need.
I could have answered this for you, probably. I bet you picked the Neil deGrasse Tyson mug too, huh?
I did, actually.
Yeah.
Do you know what milk I picked?
I'm going to guess 2%.
Nope, I picked no milk. I do not take milk in my coffee. What about sugar?
Oh, definitely. Just regular sugar.
I don't take any sugar in my coffee.
Are you some kind of monster?
I am a monster, actually. But not according to this quiz. This quiz says that based on all the selections that I made, including an additional shot of espresso and the scone that I picked at the end, I got Albus Dumbledore. Your wisdom has no equal. Your intelligence and knowledge make you seem like an old soul. Well, that and the way you drink your coffee.
Well.
So what coffee selections did you make to get to your Harry Potter character, John?
You know, I don't need everybody picking apart my life. You know, like, sometimes I just want to turn to the nearest person I'm near and just curse them with a spell and kill them on the spot, because it's fun. That's right, I got Lord Voldemort.
Oh, wow!
And, you know...
That's scary!
As they say, to put it nicely, you delight in the bad luck of others, your heart is black as night, and you would do anything to get what you want. Yes, even the unthinkable.
That's the John Deck I know.
So I'm imagining this is probably some sort of a subtle dig to people who enjoy a nice cappuccino. That's what I get out of this.
Well, you know what's funny about that is, like, the quiz starts off Accio Cappuccino. So clearly somebody had somebody was out to get cappuccino drinkers.
Well, I think we've done the hard hitting work. I guess should we just wrap up the podcast now? Or
yeah, I mean, I don't think. We have one recurring segment left that everyone seems to love, and I think I love too. Did you have any other plot stuff you want to talk about before we got to it?
Well, yeah. I do feel like we said in the beginning, we got to hit a little more of that, the end and Sirius Black's end. And I'm of two minds here, because on the one hand, the suddenness, the quick Bellatrix curse, you know, almost blink and you miss it. Like, what happened? Like, I love the fact that it is so just snap your fingers and it's done, because that kind of adds even more weight to the whole, like, not every person's going to die because of a huge battle and a huge thing. I mean, it happened with Cedric as well, but it's like, we just keep seeing these people near Harry, not Harry himself, but the people near Harry, just instantly dead. And it just made, I did actually audibly go, oh,
like, when I did it happened. Too.
But even though I knew everything, knew it was happening, knew all this stuff. But again, like I said, I remember when I was reading it, it like unfolded over pages, you know, not half a second. And that him falling back into that, not mirror, but whatever that curtain, that veil between the, you know, living and dead and all that stuff. Like, all of that happened in a way when I read the book, I was just in shock. And I was like, what?
It's not supposed to happen.
And it just, the ramifications of that, you know, just kind of made me just feel miserable. And here, practically speaking, I still had that, but it didn't hit me with a lot of emotional resonance. It was this weird balance of, like, yes, it's kind of cool and all, they showed the suddenness of this, and there wasn't a big, you know, death scene that lasted, you know, 18 minutes long where he's on the ground saying, oh, Harry, I wish you were my boy, and like, none of that stuff. But as a result, the way it was handled, it didn't have the same emotional punch to the gut Cedric's death.
It didn't, but there was still something there, because, like, you feel, at least for me, you feel the finality for Harry. Like, this is the last family I have, at least in terms of adults. Like, this is my godfather, and now he's he's gone. And, like, Remus is doing his best to comfort Harry in an obviously, like, completely inconsolable situation. And he's completely destroyed by this. And, like, you, again, at least for me, like, you really feel for him. And I got a little emotional, like, not in the same way that I did with Cedric and that whole scene playing out with his father and things like that. But to see Harry have to go through this every fucking year now, it seems like it's hard. And this then is to the see last him death. Go, this is the very last death in the whole series, thankfully.
Yeah.
But then to see him like going after Bellatrix and trying to get revenge and then that whole sequence of events playing out between him and Dumbledore versus Voldemort, and then like that the way that it ended out, and having pretty much the whole ministry show up and see Voldemort and go, oh shit, this kid and the headmaster of Hogwarts are apparently telling the truth about something that they had no reason to lie about, was satisfying.
Yeah. I thought I was going to say something else, and it's escaped my mind. I think we were in the place of the prophecies, and then Sirius Black. Remember him?
Yep, Sirius Black.
No, I do remember in the books, when I was reading the books, that like I was mildly obsessed with the idea that I thought for sure he'd be coming back to life somehow.
You get that sense, right?
Like, and even then in here, the movie, Luna, yeah, at the end, Luna's like, don't worry, Harry. Things that disappear come back, just not as you expect. Or something like that, whatever she said. And it kind of could, if you didn't know better, you know, it could kind of feed that feeling like, oh, is that it? Is that what's going to happen? And
yeah,
and
like some weird kind of foreshadowing for the, you know, upcoming movies that didn't happen.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Luna for a second, because I had this kind of evolution or maybe epiphany on Luna. Like, in previous viewings of the Harry Potter series, I didn't love Luna. Like, I found her almost annoying or grating, and I know you're not supposed to necessarily, but I did. This time around, I had an appreciation for her, and I found her to be kind of a warm alternative relief to Harry in a kindred sort of way,
yeah,
that I didn't really have a sense of in those previous viewings.
I never disliked Luna in any way, but I did. Yeah, I also had like a further appreciation of the character she brings that is understandable. Like, if I don't know if you went through this at all as a kid, but like some people, and you're going to find this hard to believe, some people thought I was a little weird as a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that whole idea of, you know, being able to have enough confidence in yourself, being able to get past being teased, being able to get over, you know, certain things and look at it from a higher perspective, you know, and, you know, just that whole thing of like she and Harry have, you know, they've been a part of, they've seen death, they've been a part of some horribleness, and it hasn't, you know, destroyed them. You know, they've found different ways to move forward and to like work through things and to be there for each other in a way. And so I really like that. I know. Well, let's see. Does Luna end up with Neville? Is that a thing?
I want to say that that's right.
I think that's right. Which is perfectly fine and all. But I think there's this like moment where it's like, huh. You know, I was wondering, is there gonna be something here? Is this something with Harry and Luna? But like, not that everything has to be like that. But especially when you're dealing with teenage kids, you never know. And so I think some of the romantic swings that happened pretty soon, you know, in the book/movies took me by surprise, to say the least. and we'll get to those when we get to them. But I thought, like, Harry and Luna, they just have a good chemistry. It doesn't have to be a romantic chemistry, but just a great chemistry and a connection. So I really like that.
Yeah, no, as characters, they play off of each other really well. And I had a newfound appreciation for that. So, Dreamcasting! What?
Is that the new theme song?
Is what the new theme song?
Dreamcasting!
We're gonna do some dreamcasting, everybody! We have... I'm probably gonna cut that out, because that was awful.
How about this?
Dreamcasting! Oh, that's it. That's the one. So... As we go through these films, we are recasting some of the adult roles. Obviously, we're not going to do the kids because that's tough to do is recasting kids, especially because kids grow up and adults have already done that. So we are
what about these adults? These adults used to be kids too. So it's like double dipping.
Exactly. What John said. So we are doing three characters this week. Dolores Umbridge, Mad-Eye Moody, and Bellatrix Lestrange. John, where did you want to start?
It doesn't matter where we start because I've got all the right answers this week. Oh. And I will win. I will
have
win,
you.
Win, win.
Okay. I didn't know that we were like having a contest here, but okay.
That's because you kept losing.
Challenge accepted. Let's start... with probably the one who gets the least screen time, Bellatrix Lestrange.
All right. You want me to go first?
Go first.
All right. And I think it's amusing after the fact to realize that I picked someone whose name is somewhat similar to the name of the actress that actually played her, which is Imelda Staunton. Is that right?
So that's Dolores Umbridge.
Right, and we're talking about Bellatrix Lestrange.
Right, who was
which
not
is a different
played,
person.
Who was played by Helena Bonham Carter.
You know what? Scratch all of that. And let me just tell you about Bellatrix Lestrange.
Sure. Great
this
start.
This was not an easy person to cast because, like so many others, Helena's just perfect and awesome. And I think one time we were talking about like a possible Fight Club recasting, and I had an easier time recasting her in that movie. But here the just the wonderful psychotic energy that she has, it's just great. So I wanted to pick someone who could really capture like that almost unreal quality, someone who isn't like really quite human, because there's something that's wrong in them, you know, and so in order to go there I went with an actress who I feel it can be very weird and otherworldly but could be super intense, and so I picked Tilda Swinton.
Okay. Yeah, Tilda Swinton making a second appearance in the casting, but a good choice.
Did you pick her for one before?
I think I picked her I want to say I picked her for McGonagall.
Ah, okay.
But yes, that's a... Or maybe I picked her for Trelawney.
No, I think I would have complimented you if you did that.
What? But you have complimented me through this at some point. Oh, anyhow.
Weird. I think it was just for Jeremy Clarkson.
it could be.
Anyway, no, that's so for Bellatrix, though. What was your pick?
So for Bellatrix, I had the same trouble you did, and picking somebody who could kind of portray the psychopath and the kind of insanity that comes along with it. So rather than try to reproduce that, I just went for somebody who could maybe do the look. And it's somebody who's already in the films, but as a child. So I went with Emma Watson.
Ah, a little comebacking.
Yes. So I think that Emma Watson would at least be able to pull off the look. She might be able to do the insanity. I don't know. We'll see.
It's interesting. To my recollection, I can't really remember any time seeing her in other roles that would make me think this is possible, which doesn't mean it's not possible. It could be one of those things where people go, what? And then, you know, her performance is amazing and everyone goes, oh my God, I can't believe she did it. So yeah. So
the only...
Could,
the only role that I could think of that might, it doesn't come close by any stretch of the imagination, but might hint at it, would be when she played herself in This Is the End.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, no, I can, now I'm thinking about that, that's pretty funny. yeah, so that's interesting, though. It's a out-of-the-box pick, or in-the-universe pick, however you want to say it.
Yeah, there we go. Let's move on to Mad-Eye Moody.
Yeah, here, I for whatever reason, like, this person popped into my head without having to search and think and debate. I just immediately, I'm like, I know who I want. I want Liam Cunningham. Sir Davos from Game of Thrones.
Oh, okay. Yes, I can totally see that. Like, I could absolutely see that, yes.
A little rough. I wanted someone with some wisdom to him. Someone who could, like, both be kind of dour and at the same time kind of have a wink and a smile to them. Like, so
sure.
He just fit. I don't know why it just popped in my head. It's not like I think about Sir Davos all the time and I have his poster above my bed. But... he just came to mind.
Hey everyone, real quick, John does have the poster above his bed, just so you're all aware. No, that's a good pick. I think
Andy, get out of my bedroom.
please continue.
I went a little bit different in terms of kind of how I thought about Mad-Eye Moody. I went a bit more of the serious route. And his ability to kind of be commanding. And I think that it still plays in terms of, like, being able to, like you said, do the kind of wink and the nod kind of thing. Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't deny that. Like, I mean, all I have to say is Kingpin.
Yeah, that's really, like, what I drew from was him as Kingpin, so...
That's really, like, he's, of course, done, you know, 300 other things, but as far as I'm concerned, that's the pinnacle. So, and that also, I think, would translate well, that kind of gravitas into mm-hmm. his character, so.
For sure.
Not bad.
Last but not least, Dolores Umbridge.
See, I'm not proud of my pick here. I think I just went a little too obvious.
Okay.
And even as we're talking, after you give your idea, I might see if I can just come up with something a little more out of the box, or maybe you'll have the better answer and I could just be at peace. I picked someone who I think would be great for the role, but in a way that would bring a certain type of intensity to it that I think is important. But I picked Kathy Bates.
Oh, I like Kathy Bates for that. I think Kathy Bates, my only issue with Kathy Bates would be that she's too... loud. Like, she her voice carries, and I'm not saying that in a bad way, just her voice carries in such a way that she could speak in the Great Hall without assistance, and with that magical or otherwise, like, she would just be able to, like, be, and that's it. Like, Umbridge, when played by Imelda Staunton, she's very almost conservative in how she uses her voice, and so I think that that's kind of part of her character.
I have two counterpoints. One, okay. Acting.
Yes.
Sometimes people act differently. Sometimes they can be louder or be quiet, or they could be angry or they could be happy. This is acting, Anthony. Okay,
it is acting.
Kathy
You're right.
Bates can act. Number two. And you probably don't have any experience with this, but there's all this technology now that lets you adjust and change the volume of people's voices when you record them. And so, like, if she's a bit too loud, they can just turn that knob down to, like, a 6, and boom. So acting and technology, what do you got? What's your answer here?
Both fair points. Okay. So for my Dolores Umbridge, I wanted somebody who kind of had that same vibe, and that was as off-putting as Dolores Umbridge was portrayed. And so I thought real hard, and I went with Alison Pill. You would know Alison Pill from, like, The Newsroom or from Snowpiercer.
Or Scott Pilgrim versus
the World. Or Scott Pilgrim versus the World, yeah.
Or the Picard.
Yep, she's in Star Trek Picard as well, that's right.
Interesting. She's so much younger than I would have thought. I could see her hitting the role and playing it well. Yeah, I think I have an issue with her youngness. Like, I just picture, and maybe that's just me, but like, I think she's a great pick for the role in terms of acting and her, you know, what she could portray and give off the vibe and all that stuff that you were saying. But I think for me, it's like anyone who's like under like 45 to me would be like, not, you know, like that would take some work for me to be like, yep, thumbs up.
That's fair. I'll give you that. My counterpoint to that would be, we have the technology that we can, you know, apply aging pretty easily. We start with the first point. Sorry?
Start with your first point, remember? That, acting.
Yeah, oh yeah, there is the acting part, for sure. Because yeah, she can act, and she can bring it. She can bring them acting chops to this role. So calm down with that part. But yeah, no, they have the aging technology. Like, they look at what they did with The Irishman. They made Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci like crazy young, or crazy old, depending on which direction they were going.
Or just crazy. I got to throw this as a rebuttal. I think we mix the two, and we go with Will Ferrell as Dolores Umbridge, wearing the same exact costume that Imelda wore, and with it just not fitting. Oh,
that's amazing!
And I think then we
and have nobody the acknowledges it.
Yep,
absolutely nobody even addresses. Nope. Not even a little bit. They all treat Will Ferrell exactly the same as they would Imelda Stanton. Yes.
Yeah, like, so I'm hesitant to bring this up because it'll sound like I'm in support of and enjoy the comedy stylings of one Mr. Kevin James, but have you seen any of his Sound Guy videos on YouTube?
I've not.
Oh my god. They're pretty darn funny. I'm reluctant to admit, but in that, they're really done well technologically, but he kind of inserts himself as a quote unquote sound guy into like famous movie scenes, and like, but they edit it so it looks like he's supposed to be there, and like the actors are yelling at him as opposed to the actual like counterpart that was in that scene or whatever it might be.
Sure.
But the thing about that is, like, I think, you know, to use that same technology, like, I'd love to see some scenes from Order of the Phoenix redone, just inserting Will Ferrell digitally as Dolores Umbridge. I understand it may not work out for real for a dream casting, but to just insert him and just playing it straight, you know, just playing it in, you know, just as perfect as possible, but the just the physical humor of it, I think would be awesome.
I'd like to see them do that with the owls scene and you know, him running from the giant fireworks dragon. I think that would just be perfect.
It would also be funny to allow him to have free reign, like a scene out with the centaurs and just have him be like, oh no, horses, and just like running around. Like, I could just see that being pretty funny.
Fantastic. I love it. All right, that's our show, everyone. Thanks so much for listening and joining us each and every week as we distill another favorite from our past. We release new episodes every Monday, so come and hang out with us. Tell a friend, tell a coworker, tell a family member about the Memory Distillery. And hey, if you have a chance, pop into Apple Podcasts or Podchaser or anywhere else that allows you to rate and review podcasts, and give us a 5-star. Give us a quick review. It helps us out a lot. It gets us a little bit of traction out there in the podcast world. So go and do that.
Speaking of traction, we want you to know that by the time you're listening to this, we have already have launched our official giveaway special. We mentioned before, we're giving away a 3-pack of Funko Pops that bring to life Harry, Ron, and Hermione in Funko Pop size. that could just be for your bookshelves, your mantle, super glue to the trunk of your car. Like, there's so many options. But yeah, keep your eye open on our Facebook page, because that's where you're going to see this contest is going to be running. And it's a pretty easy way for you to, for free, to get your name into consideration. It's going to be running for a couple weeks, so there's going to be plenty of time for you to get your name in the running. So go check that out. And while you're doing that, you're going to need some music to keep you company, because that could take a long time. And might as well suggest the music in our podcast in its totality. The song Destroying the Evidence by Semaphore.
Great song.
Pop that on, chill out, go to our Facebook page and enter the contest. It'll be a perfect mix. But if you get confused along the way, if you're just not sure, is this the right song? How do I enter? I have some problems with your whole Will Ferrell discussion. I really need to get in and have, you know, tell you about it. You should go ahead and email us at thememorydistillery@gmail.com or tweet us at TMDpod. Or just, you know, come hang out at our website, tmdpod.com. It's a fun place to chill out and have a drink and just kick your feet up and have a great weekend.
Yep, indeed. And hey, guys, don't sleep on that contest either. Like, we're giving these away. We're going to announce the winner on the Deathly Hallows episode, so the final episode of the series. So
two weeks.
So, yeah, you have 2 weeks to jump in and enter. So go and do that. We'll actually probably close it a couple days before because I edit on Saturday or Sunday. So don't sleep on this. Get in and enter. Follow the directions at facebook.com/thememorydistillery. John, any parting words for our lovely listeners?
Spectacco Patromo. I'm John Deck.
That's great.
You jumped on my line. Let me get that right. You're right. I can do more clearly and enunciate a little better. Good night. This is John Deck.
And I'm Anthony Veneri. And this has been the Memory Distillery.
I don't have a... I used my best spell. You stepped on my best spell, shit. And now my spaghetti's alive.
Do it again!
I'm gonna have to... Have you ever tried to eat spaghetti after it's been brought to life by a magic spell gone wrong?
No, it's like, let's all go eat worms. It's like that song.
No, it's not at all. I'm not comfortable with any of this. I'm going to go curl up under my Davos poster.
Oh, good night, everybody.